You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled From Jesus to Christ. It is 10 lectures, and this is the reading of the last lecture, Lecture 10. In the last lecture, we sought to characterize the way to Christ which can still be taken today, and which, especially in earlier times, could be taken by the exoteric consciousness of man. We wish now to touch briefly upon the esoteric way, that is, the way which can so lead to Christ that he can be found within the supersensible worlds. First of all, it must be noted that this esoteric path to Christ Jesus was also really the way of the evangelists, of those who wrote the Gospels. For although the writer of the John Gospel had himself seen a great part of what he gives, as you can learn for yourselves from the course of lectures on this Gospel, his chief object was not merely to represent what he himself remembered, for that gave only those minute, exact details which surprise us in this special Gospel, but the great, the majestic crowning features of the work of redemption, of the mystery of Golgotha, were received by the writer of this Gospel through his clairvoyant consciousness also. Consequently, though the Gospels are really revived mystery rituals, this is shown in my title Christianity as Mystical Fact, they are so because the writers of the Gospels, along their esoteric path, could procure for themselves, out of the supersensible world, a picture of the events in Palestine which led to the mystery of Golgotha. Since the mystery of Golgotha on into our own times, he who desired to come to a supersensible experience of the Christ event had to let that work upon him which you find described in the lectures dealing with the subject. These lectures now really belong to the elementary part of our theosophical work. Footnote, see title Investigations in Occultism. End of footnote. In them you will find described the 7 stages of our Christian initiation: the washing of the feet, the scourging, the crowning with thorns, the mystic death, the burial, the resurrection, the ascension. Today we will make clear what the pupil can attain when he allows himself to be worked upon by this Christian initiation. Let us make clear to ourselves the process of Christian initiation. Let us see in the very first place what is the point in question. As you can convince yourselves when you go through the lectures dealing with this matter, Christian initiation is not carried out as in that mistaken method of initiation described in the first lecture of this course. In Christian initiation, feelings common to humanity had first of all to work. Feelings which lead to the imagination itself of the washing of the feet. Thus the picture in the John Gospel is not the first thing to be imagined, but he who is striving for Christian initiation strives to live first of all for a long period of time with certain feelings and perceptions. I have often characterized this by saying that the person in question should gaze upon a plant which raises itself from the mineral ground, takes into itself the materials of the mineral kingdom, and, notwithstanding, raises itself out of and above this mineral kingdom as a higher being than the mineral. If now this plant could speak and feel, it would bow down to the mineral kingdom and say, quote, "Certainly I was destined within the economy of the cosmos to attain a higher stage than thou, mineral. Thou, however, dost give me the possibility of existence. In the order of beings thou art certainly a lower being than myself, but I have to thank thee, thou lower being, for my existence, and I bow myself in humility before thee." Close quote. In the same way, the animal had to bow down to the plant, although the latter is a lower being than the animal, and would have to say, quote, "Thee do I thank for my existence, I acknowledge it in humility, and I bow myself before thee." Close quote. And so would each being that climbs upward have to bow down to the other standing below, and also he who has risen above a spiritual ladder to a higher level must bow down to the beings who alone have made this possible for him. He who now permeates himself with a feeling of humility in regard to the lower, who thoroughly and entirely incorporates this feeling in his own being, and lets it live in his being for months, perhaps even for years, will see that it spreads itself out in his organization, and so pervades him that he experiences the transformation of this feeling into an imagination. And this imagination corresponds exactly to the scene which is represented in the John Gospel as the washing of the feet, where Christ Jesus, who is the head of the 12, stoops to those who stand here below him in the order of the physical world, and in humility acknowledges that he thanks those who are below him for the possibility of this higher ascent. He acknowledges before the 12, quote, "As the animal thanks the plant, so do I thank you for that which I was able to become in the physical world." Close quote. He who permeates himself with this feeling comes not only to that imagination of the washing of the feet, but also to a quite pronounced feeling, to the feeling as if water were washing over his feet. This can be felt for weeks by the person in question, and it signifies externally how deeply stamped upon our nature is such a universally human world of feeling, one which, however, raises man altogether above himself. Further, we have seen that we can go through that which leads to the imagination of the scourging, when we place the following vividly before us, quote, "Much suffering and pain will still meet me in the world. Indeed, from all sides, suffering and pain may come. In reality, no one escapes them. But I will so steel my will that suffering and pain, the scourgings that come from the world, may press in upon me. I will stand upright and bear my fate resignedly as it comes to pass. For had it not come to pass as it has done, as I have experienced it, then I should not have been able to develop to the heights which I have attained." Close quote. When the person in question makes this a matter of his perception and lives within it, he actually feels something like sharp pains and woundings, like strokes of a scourge against his own skin. And the imagination arises as if he were outside himself, and saw himself scourged according to the example of Christ Jesus. According to this example, one can experience the crowning of thorns, the mystic death, etc. This has often been described. What is attained by that man who thus seeks within himself to experience first the four stages, and when his karma is favorable, the others also, making in all seven stages of Christian initiation? From the foregoing description you can gather that the whole scale of the feelings which we go through ought to strengthen us and give us power, and ought to make us into quite another nature, so that we feel we stand in the world strong, powerful, and free, and also capable of every act of devoted love. In Christian initiation, it ought in a deep sense to become a second nature to us. For what has to happen? Perhaps it has not occurred to all of you who have read the earlier elementary cycles, and have thereby met with Christian initiation in its seven stages, that through the intensity of the experiences which must be gone through, the effects actually go as far as into the physical body. For through the strength and power with which we go through these feelings, it actually is first as if water were washing over our feet, then as if we were covered with wounds. We actually feel as if thorns were pressing into our head. We actually feel all the pain and suffering of the crucifixion. We have to feel this before we can be aware of the mystic death, of the burial, and of the resurrection, as these two have been described. Even if we have not gone through these feelings with sufficient intensity, they certainly have the effect that we become strong and full of love in the right sense of the word. But what is then embodied in us can only go as far as the etheric body. When, however, we begin to feel in our physical body that the feet are as though washed with water, the body as if covered with wounds, then we have driven these feelings more deeply into our nature, and have so advanced that they have penetrated as far as the physical body. They have really penetrated as far as the physical body. Then appear the stigmata, the places of the bleeding wounds of Christ Jesus. We drive the feelings inward into the physical body, and know that these feelings develop their strength in the physical body itself. We consciously feel ourselves more in the grip of our whole being than if the impression were merely in the astral body and etheric body. The essential characteristic may be stated as follows: that through such a process of mystic feeling, we work right into our physical body. When we do this, we do nothing less than make ourselves ready in our physical body to receive the phantom that went forth from the grave on Golgotha. Consequently, we work into our physical body in order to make it so living that it feels a relationship with, an attractive force toward, the phantom that arose out of the grave on Golgotha. And here I would make an incidental remark. In theosophy, as a matter of actual experience, one must accustom oneself to become acquainted with cosmic secrets and cosmic truths gradually. He who will not allow time in the sense characterized in these lectures, vis-à-vis that we must patiently wait for the required truths, will not make good progress. Of course, people would like to have all theosophy at once, preferably in one book or in one course of lectures. But it cannot be so. Here you have an example why it cannot be so. How long is it since, in an old course of lectures, Christian initiation was described for the first time? Quote, so-and-so takes place, and it is a fact that the individual, through the feelings which affect his soul, works right into his physical body. Close quote. Today, for the first time, it is possible, for everything which has been said in the preceding lectures of this course has been said to prepare for the understanding of the mystery of Golgotha. Today, for the first time, it is possible to describe how the individual man, through the requisite experiences of feeling in Christian initiation, makes himself ripe for receiving the phantom which arose out of the grave of Golgotha. We had to wait until the union of the subjective with the objective could be found, and for this many preparatory lectures were necessary. Thus, even today, much can only be indicated as half-truth. He who has patience to go with us, be it in this or in another incarnation, each according to his karma, he who has seen how he could advance from the description of the mystic path in the Christian sense to the description of the objective fact, to what is really the meaning of this Christian initiation, such a man will also see that still higher truths will be brought to light from theosophy in the course of the next years or the next age. Thus we see the aim, the goal of Christian initiation. Through that which has been characterized as Rosicrucian initiation, that is, what an individual can have of it as initiation today, the same thing in a certain sense is also attained, only with somewhat different means. a bond of attraction is formed between the individual, insofar as he is incorporated in a physical body, and that which arose as the real prototype of the physical body from the grave of Golgotha. But now we know, from the beginning of this course of lectures, that we stand at the starting point of a world epoch, in which an event must be expected, which will not take place, as did the event of Golgotha upon the physical plane, but which will happen in the higher world, in the supersensible world, an event which, nevertheless, stands in a close and true connection with the event of Golgotha. Whereas the latter was designed to give back to man his real physical force body, the phantom, which had degenerated from the beginning of the earth evolution, and for the giving back of which, at the beginning of our era, a series of events was necessary, which actually took place on the physical plane, so, for that which is now to happen, an event on the physical plane is not necessary. An incarnation of the Christ being in a human body of flesh could only take place once in the course of the earth evolution. It simply means that the Christ being is not understood when people announce a repetition of the incarnation of this being. That, however, which happens, which belongs to a supersensible world, and which can be observed only in a supersensible world, has been characterized in the words, quote, "Christ becomes for men the Lord of Karma," close quote. That is to say, the ordering of karmic transactions will in future happen through Christ. Ever more and more will men of the future feel, quote, "I am going through the gate of death with my karmic account. On the one side stand my good, clever, and beautiful deeds, my clever, beautiful, good, and intelligent thoughts. On the other side stands everything evil, wicked, stupid, foolish, and loathsome. But he who, in the future, will have the office of judge for the incarnations which will follow in human evolution, to bring order into this karmic account of men, is the Christ." Close quote. And in very deed we have to imagine this to ourselves as follows. After we have gone through the gate of death, we shall be incarnated again in a later period. Events will have to happen for us, through which our karma can be balanced, for every person must reap what he has sown. Karma remains a righteous law. But what the karmic law has to fulfill is not only there for individual men. Karma does not only balance the accounts of each ego, but in the case of each individual, the balancing must take place so that, in the best possible way, the karmic account fits in with the general concern of the whole world. We must so balance our karma that we can help forward in the best possible manner the progress of the whole human race on the earth. For this, we need enlightenment. For this we do not require only the general knowledge that the karmic fulfillment of our deeds must take place. Karmic fulfillment, which can compensate for a deed, may be of this or that nature. But because one way of fulfillment would be more serviceable for the general progress of humanity than another, we must choose those thoughts, feelings, and perceptions which pay off our karma, and at the same time serve the collective progress of humanity. It falls in the future to Christ to bring the balance of our karma into line with the general earth karma, with the general progress of humanity. And it happens principally in the time in which we live between death and a new birth. But it will also be prepared in the epoch of time which we are approaching, before the door of which we stand. Because man, in fact, will acquire more and more the capacity for having a special experience. Today only a very few possess it, but continually more and more persons from the present time, from the middle of this century onward, through the next 1,000 years, will have the following experience. The person in question has done this or that. He will bethink himself, will have to gaze on what he has done, and something like a dream picture will rise up, which will make a quite remarkable impression on him. He will say to himself, quote, "I cannot recall that it is a remembrance of something that I have done, but yet it is as if it were an experience of mine." Close quote. Like a dream picture, it will stand there before him, closely concerned with him, but he cannot recall that he has experienced it or done it in the past. If he is a theosophist, he will understand the matter. Otherwise, he will have to wait until he comes to theosophy and learns to understand it. The theosophist will know, quote, "What thou seest as a consequence of thine acts is a picture that will be accomplished in the future by thee. The balancing of thy deeds appears to thee beforehand." Close quote. The epoch is beginning, in which men, in the moment in which they have committed a deed, will have a premonition, a feeling, perhaps even a significant picture, of the way this deed will be balanced by karma. Thus, in closest connection with human experience, enhanced capabilities will arise for humanity for the next epoch. These capabilities will be mighty impulses to modern morality. And these impulses will signify something quite different from the voice of conscience, which has been the preparation for these impulses. The individual will no longer believe, quote, "That which thou hast done is something that dies with thee." But he will know quite exactly, quote, "The act will not die with thee. As an act it will have a consequence, which will live further with thee." Close quote. And many another thing will the individual know. The time in which men closed the doors to the spiritual world is approaching its end. Men must again climb upward to the spiritual world. The capacities will so awake that men will be partakers of the spiritual world. Clairvoyance will always be something different from this participation. Just as there was an ancient clairvoyance which was dreamlike, so there will be a future clairvoyance that is not dreamlike, a clairvoyance wherein people will know what they have done and what it signifies. Something else will also come about. The individual will know, quote, "I am not alone. Everywhere there live spiritual beings who stand in relationship to me." Close quote. And men will learn to have intercourse with these beings and to live with them. And in the next 3,000 years, that which we may call the karmic judgeship of Christ will appear as a truth to a sufficiently large number of persons. Christ himself will be experienced by men as an etheric form. Men will so experience him that, like Paul before Damascus, they will know quite intimately that Christ lives and is the source for the reawakening of the physical prototype which we received at the beginning of our earth evolution and which we need if the ego is to attain its full development. If, on the one hand, with the mystery of Golgotha, something happened which gave the greatest impetus to human earth evolution, on the other hand, this mystery of Golgotha fell in that time of human evolution in which the human mind, the human soul, was in its darkest condition. There were indeed ancient periods of human evolution in which men could know with certainty, because they had an ancestral memory, that the human individuality goes through repeated earth lives. The teaching of repeated earth lives appears to us in the gospel only when we understand the gospel, only when we feel in it the traces of the teaching. That was the time when men were least in a condition to understand this teaching. In the days when men sought for Christ along the path indicated in the preceding lecture, Everything had to take the form of a childlike preparation. Consequently, men could not be made acquainted with experiences concerning reincarnation, experiences which would have led them only into error, and for which they were not yet ripe. Christianity had to develop nearly 2,000 years without its being possible to indicate the teaching of reincarnation. We have shown in these lectures how different the case was in Buddhism, and how in Western consciousness the thought of repeated earth lives arises as something self-understood. Many misunderstandings certainly still prevail, but whether we take this idea from Lessing or from the psychologist Drosbach, we become aware that for the European consciousness the teaching of reincarnation is a matter for the whole of humanity, whereas in Buddhism the individual regards the question how he goes from life to life, how he can free himself from the thirst for existence, as an inner concern of his own life. The Oriental makes what is given to him as teaching about reincarnation into a path of individual redemption. Whereas for Lessing, the essential question was, quote, how can the whole of humanity move forward? Close quote. According to Lessing, we must distinguish successive periods of time within the progressive development of humanity. Something new is given to humanity in every single epoch. We see from history that new civilized acts continually appear in the course of human development. How could one speak of the evolution of the whole of humanity, says Lessing, if a soul lived only in one epoch? From whence could the fruits of civilization come if human beings were not born again, if that which they had learned in one epoch were not carried over into the next, this again into the following, and so on? Thus for Lessing, the idea of repeated earth lives is a concern of the whole of humanity. It is not only a concern of the individual soul, it is a concern of the whole course of earthly civilization. And in order that an advanced civilization may arise, the soul which lives in the 19th century must carry over into its present existence that which it had gained earlier. For the sake of the earth and its civilization, human beings must be born again. That is Lessing's thought. The thought of reincarnation appears as a concern of humanity. But here the Christ impulse has been at work. It has been woven into it, for the Christ impulse made a concern of humanity out of everything that man does or can do, not a matter which touches man only as an individual. That man only can be Christ's disciple who says, quote, I do it to the least of the brethren, because I know thou dost feel as if I had done it unto thee. Close quote. As the whole of humanity is bound up with Christ, so does he who confesses Christ feel himself belonging to the whole of humanity. This thought has worked into the thinking, feeling, and perception of the whole of the human race. And when the idea of reincarnation reappeared in the 18th century, it appeared as a Christian thought. And again, looking at Wiedemann, although he treated reincarnation clumsily as in embryo, yet in his prize essay of 1851, his thought of reincarnation is permeated by the Christian impulse. There is a special character in the treatise where the connection is shown between Christianity and the teaching of reincarnation. It was necessary in human evolution that souls should first accept the other Christian impulses, so that the thought of reincarnation might enter into human consciousness in a ripe form. And in very deed, this thought of reincarnation will so connect itself with Christianity that one will feel it as something that leads him on through each single incarnation. We shall understand how individuality, which, as we have seen from the conversation of King Milinda with the sage Nagasena, is completely lost according to the Buddhist view, first receives its true content by becoming permeated with Christ. We now can understand why the Buddhist view, about 500 years before the appearance of Christ, lost the human ego, while retaining the teaching of successive incarnations. The time has come in which the human organization must understand, accept, permeate itself with the thought of reincarnation, for the progress of human evolution does not depend on what teachings are promulgated, what teachings find a new foothold. Other laws come into consideration which do not depend upon ourselves. Certain powers will be developed in human nature in the approaching future, which will so work that the individual, as soon as he has reached a certain age and has become properly conscious of himself, will feel, quote, "There is something in me which I must understand," close quote. This feeling will take hold of men more and more. In past times, even when human beings were ever so conscious of themselves, the consciousness which is now to come did not exist. It will express itself somewhat as follows, quote, "I feel something within me which is connected with my personal ego. It is strange. It will not fit in with all that I know since my present birth," close quote. One man will understand, another will not understand what is at work here. A man will understand it if he has made the teachings of theosophy his life possession. He will then know, quote, "What I am now feeling, I feel foreign to me because it is the ego that has come over from earlier lives," close quote. This feeling will oppress the heart, will cause fear and anxiety in those who cannot explain it by repeated earth lives. Such a feeling, which is no theoretical doubt, but a starving, a cramping of life, will disappear through those perceptions which are given to us by theosophy, perceptions which attest, quote, "Thou must think of thy life as extended over earlier earth lives," close quote. Then men will see what it means for them to experience the connection with the Christ impulse. For it will be the Christ impulse which will give life to the whole retrospective view, to the whole perspective into the past. Men will feel, quote, "Here was this incarnation, there that one," close quote. Then a time will be reached beyond which one will be unable to go without clearly understanding that, quote, "The Christ impulse was then on the earth," close quote. Incarnations will be followed further back when the Christ event was not yet there. This illumination of the retrospective view through the Christ impulse will be needed by men for their assurance in the future as a necessity and a help which can pour itself into the incarnations yet to come. This transformation will come in the organization of the human soul. It will rise out of the event which begins in the 20th century, and which we may call the second Christ event, so that those persons who have awakened their higher faculties will look upon the Lord of Karma. Those men, however, who will experience this event will not merely be those who experience it in the physical world. Some of you may say that when the chief event, the Christ event of the 20th century, takes place, many of those now living will be with those who have fallen asleep, will be in the time between death and a new birth. But whether a soul will be living in a physical body or in the time between death and a new birth, if that soul has prepared itself for the Christ event, it will experience it. The vision of the Christ event does not depend on whether we are incarnated in a physical body, but the preparation for the Christ event does so depend. Just as it was necessary that the first Christ event should take place on the physical plane in order that the salvation of man could be achieved, so must the preparation be made here in the physical world, the preparation to look with full understanding, with full illumination upon the Christ event of the 20th century. For the person who looks upon it unprepared when his powers have been awakened will not understand it. then the appearance of the Lord of Karma will be to him a terrible punishment. In order to have an illumined understanding of this event, the individual must be prepared. The spreading abroad of the theosophical world conception has taken place in our time for this purpose, that men could be prepared on the physical plane to perceive the Christ event, either on the physical plane or on the higher planes. Those who are not sufficiently prepared on the physical plane, and then unprepared, go through the life between death and a new birth, must wait until in the next incarnation they can be prepared through theosophy for the understanding of Christ. During the next 3,000 years, however, the opportunity will be given to men of going through this preparation, and the purpose of all theosophical development will be to render man more and more capable of familiarizing himself with that which is to come. Thus we understand how the past goes into the future. We see, for example, how the Buddha forces continue to work, when we recall how the Buddha worked into the astral body of the Jesus child, after he himself needed no longer to reincarnate again upon the earth. We see how the spiritual world works into the physical world, when we remember that that which was not directly concerned with the Buddha was exactly that which worked in the West. All this preparation is, in a certain way, connected again with the fact that men are always drawing nearer and nearer to an ideal which had actually dawned in ancient Greece, an ideal formulated by Socrates. When man grasps the idea of the good, the moral, the ethical, he feels this idea is so magic an impulse that he becomes capable of living according to it as an ideal. Today we are not so far advanced that this ideal can be realized. Today we are only so far advanced that in certain circumstances a man may very easily think the good, he may be very clever and wise, and yet he need not be morally good. The direction of inner evolution, however, will be that the ideas which we hold of the good are also immediately moral impulses. That will be the direction of the evolution which we shall experience in the times that are approaching. And the teachings upon earth will be ever more and more such that in the following centuries and millennia, human speech will acquire an unexpected effect, greater than in past ages or in the present. Today in the higher worlds, anyone can see clearly what the connection is between intellect and morality, but there is, as yet, no human speech which works so magically that when a moral principle is stated, it sinks down into the man to whom it is a new idea, so that he perceives it as directly moral, and cannot do otherwise than carry it out as a moral impulse. After the next 3,000 years, it will be possible to speak to men in such a speech as cannot today be entrusted to our brain. It will be such that everything intellectual will at the same time be moral, and that which is moral will penetrate into the hearts of men. The human race must become, in the next 3,000 years, permeated with magic morality. Otherwise the human race would not be able to bear such an evolution. It would only misuse it. For the special preparation of an evolution of this kind, that individuality existed who about a century before our era was much slandered, and who was mentioned, though certainly in a distorted form, in Hebrew literature as Jeshu ben Pandira, Jesus the son of Pandira. From lectures once held in Bern, some of you know that this Jeshu ben Pandira had already worked in preparation for the Christ event. In that, he trained pupils, among whom was one who became the teacher of the writer of the Gospel of Matthew. Jeshu ben Pandira, a noble Essene figure, preceded Jesus of Nazareth by a century. Jesus of Nazareth himself only went among the Essenes, whereas Jeshu ben Pandira was altogether an Essene. Who was Jeshu Ben Pandira? The successor of that bodhisattva, who in his last incarnation had risen in his 29th year to be Gautama Buddha, was incarnated in the physical body of Jeshu Ben Pandira. Every bodhisattva who rises to the rank of a Buddha has a successor. This oriental tradition corresponds exactly with occult research. The bodhisattva who worked at that time in preparation for the Christ event was incarnated again and again. One of his incarnations is fixed for the 20th century. It is impossible to speak here more exactly concerning the reincarnation of the bodhisattva. Something can, however, be said about the way in which such a bodhisattva may be recognized in his reincarnation. Through a law which will be demonstrated and explained in future lectures, it is a peculiarity of this bodhisattva that when he reappears reincarnated, and he always reappears thus in the course of the centuries, he is quite dissimilar in his youth from that which he is in his later activities. At a quite definite point of time in the life of this reincarnated bodhisattva, something like a great reaction, like a great transformation, always takes place. To express it more in detail, in some place or other, a more or less gifted child is living in whom it is not noticeable that he has to do anything special in preparation for the future evolution of humanity. Occult research tells us that no one shows so little in his youth, in the first years of childhood, of what he really is, as he who is to reincarnate as a bodhisattva. But at a quite definite period of his life, a great reaction takes place for the reincarnation of a bodhisattva. If an individuality of the remote past, for example Moses, reincarnates, it is not as it was in the case of the Christ individuality, to whom the other individuality, Jesus of Nazareth, left the sheaths. In the case of the bodhisattva, there certainly will be something like an exchange, but the individuality in a definite sense remains. The individuality, patriarch or other person, who then comes out of the remote past and who is to bring new forces for the evolution of humanity, descends, and the human being who receives him experiences thereby an immense transformation. This transformation takes place especially between the 30th and 31st years. It can never be known before the transformation takes place that this very body will be taken possession of by the bodhisattva. The change never shows itself in youth. The distinctive feature is precisely that the later years are so unlike the youthful ones. He who was incarnated in Jeshu Ben Pandira, the bodhisattva who was repeatedly reincarnated, and who succeeded Gautama Buddha, he has prepared himself for his bodhisattva incarnation so that he can appear and can rise to the Buddha dignity exactly 5,000 years after the illumination of Gautama Buddha under the Bodhi tree. Here again, occult investigation fully agrees with Oriental tradition. 3,000 years hence, that bodhisattva, looking back on all that has happened in the new epoch, and looking back on the Christ impulse and all that is connected with it, will so speak that a speech will fall from his lips, which will be the realization of what has just been characterized, vis-à-vis that intellectuality becomes directly moral. The future bodhisattva, who will place all that he has at the service of the Christ impulse, will be a bringer of the good through the word, through the Logos. He will speak in a language as yet possessed by no man, but which is so holy that he who speaks it can be called a bringer of the good. This also will not show itself in his youth, but approximately in his 31st year he will appear as a new man and will yield himself up as the one who can be filled with a higher individuality. The experience of one single incarnation in the flesh holds good only for Christ Jesus. All bodhisattvas go through various successive incarnations on the physical plane. This bodhisattva, 3,000 years hence, will have advanced so far that he will be a bringer of the good, Maitreya Buddha, who will place his words of good at the service of the Christ impulse, with which impulse a sufficiently large number of men by that time will have familiarized themselves. Prevision of the future development of man tells us this today. What was necessary so that human beings could come gradually to this epoch of evolution? This we can make clear as follows. If we wish to make a graphic picture of what happened in ancient Lemuria for the earth evolution of man, we can say that man at that time descended from divine heights. It was ordained for him that he should develop further in a certain way, but through the luciferic influence he was cast down more deeply into matter than would have been the case without that influence. Thereby his path in evolution became different. When man had gone downward to the lowest step, a mighty impetus was needed upward. This impetus could only come because that being from the higher hierarchies whom we designate as the Christ being had in the higher worlds formed a resolution which he would not have needed to form for his own evolution. For the Christ being would also have attained his evolution if he had taken a path far, far above all that lay in the path which men were pursuing. He could have passed by, so to speak, could have passed by far above the evolution of humanity. But if the upward impulse had not been given, human evolution would have been such that the downward path must have continued. The Christ would have had an ascent, but humanity a downfall. Only through the fact that the Christ being had taken the resolution to unite himself at the point of time of the events of Palestine with a man, to embody himself in a man, to make the upward path possible for humanity. Only through this was that evolution of humanity brought about which we may now name redemption, the redemption of humanity from that impulse which came from the luciferic forces, which in the Bible is designated symbolically as original sin, as the temptation by the serpent, and the bringing about of original sin. Christ accomplished something that was not necessary for Christ himself. What kind of act was this? It was an act of divine love. We must be quite clear that there is no human feeling which is at all in the condition to realize that intensity of love which was needed for a God to make the decision, which he himself did not require, to work upon earth in a human body. Thereby, as through an act of love, that event was brought about which is the most important in human evolution. And when men grasp the love act of God, when they try to grasp it as a great ideal, in contrast with which every human act of love can be but small, then through the feeling of utter disproportion between human love and that divine love needed for the mystery of Golgotha, men draw near to the building up, to the giving birth within them, of those imaginations which place before our spiritual gaze this momentous event of Golgotha. Yes, verily, it is possible to attain to imagination of the mount on which the cross was raised, that cross on which hung a God in human body, a God who out of his own free will, that is, out of love, accomplished the act whereby the earth and humanity could attain their goal. If the God who is designated by the name of the Father had not at one time permitted the luciferic influences to come to man, man would not have developed the condition for the free ego. With the luciferic influence, the foundation for the free ego was developed. That had to be permitted by the Father God. But just as the ego, for the sake of freedom, had to become entangled in matter, so now to be set free from this entanglement in matter, the whole love of the Son had to lead to the act of Golgotha. Through this alone the freedom of man, the complete dignity of man, first became possible. We have to thank a divine act of love that we can be free beings. As men we may feel free beings, but we may never forget that for this freedom we have to thank God's act of love. The thought will rise up in the midst of our feeling, quote, "Thou canst attain to the value, the dignity of a man. But one thing thou mayest not forget, that for being what thou art, thou hast to thank him who has brought back to thee again thy human prototype through the redemption on Golgotha." Close quote. Men should not be able to lay hold of the thought of freedom without the thought of redemption through Christ. Only then is the thought of freedom justified. If we will to be free, we must bring the offering of thanks to Christ for our freedom. Then only can we really perceive it. And those who consider that their dignity as men is restricted when they thank Christ for it should recognize that human opinions brought face to face with cosmic facts are of no significance, and that one day they will own right gladly that their freedom was won by Christ. What we have been able to do in these lectures is not very much for the bringing about of a closer understanding of the Christ impulse and of the whole course of evolution of humanity upon earth from the standpoint of spiritual science. We can only bring together single stones for the building. But if the effect upon our souls is such that we feel something like a stimulus to further effort, to further development along the path of knowledge, then these stones will have done their work for the great spiritual temple of humanity. And the best that we can carry away from a theosophical study such as this is that once more we have learned something toward a certain end, that we have again somewhat enriched our knowledge. And our lofty goal is this, that we may know more exactly how much we still need to know. Then we shall be more and more permeated with the truth of the old Socratic saying, quote, "The more a man learns, the more he knows how little he knows." Close quote. But this conviction is good only when it is not an acknowledgement of inactive, effortless resignation, but an acknowledgement of a living will and effort toward an ever-extending knowledge. We ought not to acknowledge how little we know by saying, quote, "We cannot know everything, so we would rather learn nothing, folding our hands in our lap." Close quote. That would be a false result of theosophic study. The right one is to be more and more inspired to further striving, to consider every new thing learned a fresh step forward toward the attainment of yet higher stages. Perhaps in this particular course of lectures much has been said of the redemption thought without the word having been used. This redemption thought should be felt by the theosophist as it was felt by a great forerunner of our Western theosophy, that it is only related to us and entrusted to our souls according to our striving after the highest goal of knowing, feeling, and willing. And as the great forerunner of our Western theosophy connects the word redemption with the word effort, and has expressed it in the line, "Wer immer strebend sich bemüht, den können wir erlösen." Close quote. Quote, "Him who abateth not endeavor, we can redeem." Close quote. So should the theosophist ever feel. He only can grasp and feel the true redemption who wills to do so within his own sphere, who abateth not endeavor. May this course, which has been specially laid upon my heart, because in it so much has to be said concerning the redemption thought, be a stimulus to our further endeavor. May we ever more and more find ourselves united in our endeavor in this and in following incarnations. May this be the fruit that results from such studies. With this we will close, taking with us the stimulating thought, man must ever weary himself in striving, so that on the one side he may see what Christ is, and on the other that we may be able to draw nearer to the redemption, which is not merely being set free from the lower earth path and from earth fate, but also being set free from everything that constitutes a hindrance to man in the way of attaining his dignity as man. But these are things which in their truth are only written down in the annals of the spiritual. For the writing that can be read in spirit land is the only true writing. Let us therefore strive to read the chapter concerning the dignity of man and the mission of man in the writing in which these things stand written in the spiritual worlds. The end of Lecture 10 and the end of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled From Jesus to Christ. You have been listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com.